American media is a business, and it has a mission. Not to inform Americans, but to entertain them.
You know, there's happy news for happy people with happy problems.
And the business leaders said that they had to renew with vigor what they called the everlasting battle for the minds of men and indoctrinate citizens with the capitalist story.
Global corporations feeding us the news as they see fit.
Truth is subversive. It's anti-American.
Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on Earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly.
And it is a good day. This is Ryan Robson reporting to you from the internet for Monday, October 10th, 2011. You are listening to Newsreel, the Wall Global Sit-Rep on Corrupt Political Tyranny, Technology, and Trends for your headspace and timing. Rant Media is taking a stand for free speech today, and just by listening and distributing this program, you are too. Also standing up for free speech is Misanthropic Gods.
You can follow all these stories and check our facts by going to the Rant Media forums and looking under Newsreel for a post with today's date. You get there by going to smf.rantradio.com, and this should be a free podcast. It can be heard on Rant Radio Talk, Galaxy 15 Radio, and recorded live in Second Life every Thursday night at 7 p.m. SL time at Great Archers, 155-74666. And just a little side note here, Yuko managed to spell the show name wrong in his own format. Way to go, buddy. But what we need right now most of all is your support. If you have something to send us, please email us at news@rostudios.com. Joining us live in Second Life today is Morp Skytower, Legion Rosenman, and Anastasia Jennings.
For the record, it's autocorrect fucking with me. And I'd just like to mention first, we got about a billion emails with the whole Steve Jobs thing. Yes, we know he's dead. It's kind of a mainstream story. And while I'll say it's always bad whenever someone who's not completely evil dies, I don't really want to talk about the Steve Jobs thing any more than this little blurb. So, moving right along into real news. In controlling alt media news, thanks to Psychros for this. The Federal Reserve plans to identify key bloggers and monitor billions of conversations about the Fed on Facebook, Twitter, forums, and blogs. The Federal Reserve wants to know what you are saying about it. In fact, the Federal Reserve has announced plans to identify key bloggers and monitor billions of conversations about the Fed on Facebook, Twitter, forums, and blogs. This is yet another sign that the alternative media is having a dramatic impact. As first reported on Zero Hedge, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has issued a request for proposal to suppliers who may be interested in participating in the development of a sentiment analysis and social media monitoring solution. In other words, the Federal Reserve wants to develop a highly sophisticated system that will gather everything that you and I say about the Federal Reserve on the internet, and it will analyze what your feelings about the Fed are. Obviously, any positive feelings about the Fed would not be a problem. And what they really want is to gather information on anyone who views the Federal Reserve negatively, which is probably a good chunk of our audience. It is unclear how they plan on to use this information once they have it. But considering that many alternative media sources have been shut down lately, this is obviously a very troubling sign. You can read this request for proposal right here, which is a link in the news article. Posted below are some of the key quotes from the document in bold, which with some of my own commentary in between the quotes, my own being the person who wrote this article. The intent is to establish a fair and equitable partnership with a market leader who will gather data from various social media outlets and news sources and provide applicable reporting to FRBNY, Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The request for proposal, RFP, was created in an effort to support FRBNY's Social Media Listening Platforms Initiative. A system like this is not cheap. Apparently, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York believes that gathering all the information is very important. In recent years, criticism of the Federal Reserve has become very intense, and most of this criticism has been coming from the internet. It has gotten to the point where the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has decided that it better listen to what's being said and find out who is saying it. Social media listening platforms are solutions that gather data from various social media outlets and news sources. They monitor billions of conversations and generate text analysis based on predefined criteria. They can also determine the sentiment of a speaker or a writer with respect to some topic or document.
You know, this is, again, you know, don't have your shit public if you're posting shit up. You know, realize that it's going to be monitored by law enforcement entities, by, you know, independent, you know, companies, by, you know, anybody that can, that wants to look it up, they pretty much can. So, again, you know, practice InfoSec, you know, keep your shit locked down. They are looking for your opinions, regardless of how small you think you are. Somebody wants to know what you think. And, you know, these guys, I noticed that this article is really, really bad. They're almost as bad as with acronyms as the military is. Jesus Christ. But another interesting topic some people may not realize is that the Federal Reserve, I know this is, you know, old news to a lot of people, but some people are quite surprised by it, but the Federal Reserve is not actually an entity of the government. They are a private corporation. So, you know, if you ever see, you know, Federal Reserve or anything like that, realize that it's a private corporation, not the actual government.
And it's scary how much this private corporation, how much power this private corporation has. But this is one of the reasons why anonymity is key to free speech. Because, of course, we can't just stop speaking out against them because they're starting to track people. So you need to make sure that you can't be easily found if you're saying things that you know are going to get you in trouble. And especially if you are in a position where your life could be seriously fucked up if you go to jail, like, say, parents and stuff like that. So, I mean, I'm not saying to stop being active. I'm saying that be more careful about it. Don't put yourself out there on the line like we do, because we're big idiots over here. And make sure that that it's not so easy for them to link you, the individual, to what you're saying. Because even small guys aren't immune to it now. I mean, with this tracking software, all you gotta do is put all the blogs that they can find through this software, and it's gonna spit out the names of people who are dissenters. You can't even be hidden by obscurity anymore.
They are after your information. They can make money off of your information. They can, you know, get intelligence off of your information. They're able to work against you with this information that you're putting out freely. Twitter, Facebook, you know, all those places like that, you know, they have their eyes on it. This, you know, this isn't some little backwater part of the internet anymore. This is, you know, up front and center, you know, this is where they're looking for information. Police are looking at Facebook profiles, you know, government entities are looking at Facebook profiles. If you're getting hired by places, they're looking at Facebook profiles, they're looking at Twitter, they're looking at all that stuff. You know, and if you are going to do it, possibly have multiple accounts that, you know, aren't linked by email addresses or names or close, you know, pseudonyms or anything like that, something completely separate. And keep your public and private life, you know, totally, you know, separate from each other if you possibly can.
Use throwaway emails. I mean, there's so many email services out there, you can easily make some throwaways. So, you know, just use some throwaways there. That'll protect you a little bit more. Of course, that's not the only bad thing going on in world police news, thanks to the doctor. NYPD chief, police could take down plane if needed. The chief of New York Police Department says city police could take down a plane if necessary. Commissioner Ray Kelly tells CBS 60 Minutes after the September 11th attacks, he decided the city couldn't rely on the federal government alone. He set about creating the NYPD's own counterterrorism unit. He says the department is prepared for multiple scenarios and could even take down a plane. Kelly didn't divulge the details, but he said obviously this would be a very extreme situation. Other measures include sending NYPD officers abroad, using radiation detectors, and creating a network of surveillance cameras in Manhattan. Now, most of this isn't that surprising to me. The plane thing is, and sending NYPD officers abroad is, that those two seem way out of line for a city police department.
Okay, this article is, you know, 99% hype here. They haven't, you know, put any type of common sense toward this at all. I actually saw this come up on the wire last week, you know, and I was monitoring some news sites that had it, so I decided to do a little bit more research. And it's not like these guys have, you know, anti-aircraft, you know, surface to air rockets or anything like that. This is essentially them putting, you know, spin on it and, you know, overestimating their capabilities. Because essentially what it's saying here is that they could take down a plane. And by plane, they mean a Cessna. Cessnas are slow. They're pretty flimsy. They're not talking about a commercial airliner. They're not talking about, you know, anything like what happened on 9/11. They're talking about guys in NYPD helicopters, which they have quite a few of, with rifles, you know, pretty much standard AR rifles, maybe something in 7.62, you know, And, shooting at a plane, you know, shooting out the engine or physically, you know, shooting a pilot. So that's essentially what they're saying here. Whenever you think about it that way, it's not really all that scary.
Actually, that seems a little bit like a Die Hard plot, you know, trying to take down a Cessna with a helicopter and a sniper rifle.
Yeah, or something like at a silent scope or whatever.
In crowdsourcing science news, thanks to Jules Verboven. Gamers decode AIDS protein that stumped researchers for 15 years in just 3 weeks. You no longer need a PhD to make an incredible scientific breakthrough. Which, I hate that line, because most researchers are not doctors. But I digress. A 15-year-old AIDS problem has been recently solved in just 3 weeks, using a new online game site that allows users to contribute in decoding complex proteins. Fold.it users incredibly remodeled the protein, remodeled the enzyme, Maison Pfizer monkey virus, MPMV, retroviral protease, in a manner that matched crystalline structures observed by scientists. Simply put, Fold.it allows users to predict the shape and protein and map it using a game-like structure. The better the model, the more points you get. In this case, however, scientists experimented with giving users 3 weeks to create a model of a protein that scientists haven't been able to model on the molecular level themselves. At the end of the 3-week period, scientists compared the best models to X-ray crystallography of the protein. They discovered that at least one group of the players had determined the correct structure for it, according to the Fold.it blog. The findings were published in Structural and Molecular Biology section of the September 18th version of the journal Nature. Fold.it has gained over 236,000 players since it started in 2008. The findings were published in a structural... Amazingly, according to PC Magazine, few of the players involved had any background in biochemistry at all. Fold.it was developed by researchers at the University of Washington with hopes of bringing a human element back to the modeling process. People have spatial reasoning skills, something computers are not very good at yet. Seth Cooper, Fold.it's lead developer, said in a news release, according to MSNBC. Games provide a framework for bringing together the strengths of computers and humans. However, the protein revelation is just one small part of the AIDS puzzle. It appears in the monkey version of AIDS and plays a key role in the multiplication of the virus. With an accurate model of this protein, drugs can be created which could potentially help stymie the multiplication of the virus in humans. And there's an update here. While the open time frame for creating the structure was 3 weeks, according to MSNBC, the correct answer is found in just 10 days.
This is, you know, really good. I really like the fact that they're, you know, outsourcing this and open sourcing these types of research to, you know, they're opening it up, not open sourcing really, but they're, you know, opening it up to where, you know, everyday people are able to participate in these and help advance science. And that's really what we need to do. We need to, you know, stop having this whole ivory tower bullshit with, you know, companies and, you know, universities and stuff. We need to get people every day involved in this, you know, everyday normal people involved in this type of stuff. I mean, this is really how we learn about our environment is, you know, not the select few knowing about it, but, you know, actually getting to where we have everybody participating in. And, you know, we can get great advances in, you know, drug technology and stuff like that, but it also, you know, it educates the everyday layman on the street.
One thing I find striking about this is the fact that pretty recently we've come to the conclusion that philosophy doesn't really have much of a contributing factor to science anymore, just because of where science has gone. The mental process of philosophy used to be quite helpful in determining past research and stuff like that, but these days it's kind of gone by the wayside. So I see this as a new way of applying non-standard ways of thinking, like philosophy, to science again, so we can move it into a new realm where all this brain power, which is now not being used anymore, can be put back directly into research and be put directly in the hands of researchers so that they can get through, like, it took them 15 years to figure out this protein. A bunch of gamers did in a couple weeks, mainly because you got all these different people thinking in different ways. You're gonna get a little more progress doing that. moving right along, and we have an InfoSec alert here. Weaponized BIOS rootkit in the wild, thanks to the doctor. Webroot discovers BIOS rootkit. Security software company Webroot says a BIOS rootkit has been found in the wild. Called Mebromi, some weird name. The malware reminiscent of Ice Lord proof of concept BIOS rootkit in 2007 was a late 1990s virus that was able to crash, was able to erase motherboard software. The new rootkit is a different caliber, as it appears to be the one that is most persistent, that is one of the most persistent malware programs we've heard of so far. According to Webroot, Mebromi targets a word BIOS and attaches itself so it can infect a client computer over and over again. The malware then infects the master boot record to be able to infect winlogon.exe or winnt.exe to be able to use Windows to download additional software or additional malware. There is no easy way to get rid of Mebromi at this time, as traditional antivirus software won't reach down to the BIOS level. Webroot said that the rootkit was targeting Chinese users and seems to be remodeled closely after the Ice Lord proof of concept, which was demonstrated in 2007. The company stated that storing the malicious code inside the BIOS ROM could actually become more than just a problem for security software, given the fact that even if an antivirus detects and cleans the MBR infection master boot record, it will be restored at the very next system startup when the malicious BIOS payload could overwrite the MBR code again. Webroot's Marco Giuliani noted that developing an antivirus utility able to clean the BIOS is a challenge because it needs to be totally error-proof to avoid rendering the system unbootable at all, he added. The job of handling with such specific system codes should be left to developers of the specific motherboard model, who release BIOS updates along with a specific tool to target BIOS code.
You know, this really shows, you know, a weakness and a deficiency in the security that it's come about. You know, is BIOS has pretty much, you know, stayed consistent for, you know, a good number of years now, and the security there hasn't been upped at all. It's, you know, still pretty much the same shit. So, you know, it really shows a glaring flaw in computer security. You know, you can have all the software you want on your computer, but if it's fucking with your BIOS, you're done.
Yeah, to any non-technical people out there, the BIOS is that little screen you see when you first start up the computer before, like, Windows or whatever starts loading. That software pretty much is consistent across all modern computers and doesn't change very much other than some motherboard manufacturers updating it. So if that gets infected, then no matter, like, you could erase Windows and put it back and the virus would be back. That's the problem here. Now, as far as I can tell from this news article, it looks like it only affects Windows, so if you're using Linux or whatever right now, you should be fine. But the point is, since they can affect the BIOS with this, they could easily make the malware that it infects your computer with infect any operating system. It just apparently is only popping Windows so far. So this is a concern for everyone right now. If you're really concerned about it, Linux can be a temporary workaround. But I hope a tool comes out soon that can clean this. In surveillance news. Oh, you have something to say?
No, I was just going to agree with you, you know, that, yeah, we do need to, you know, like I said, this is a glaring security flaw. We should be able to, you know, plug this up.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Hopefully, it doesn't say in this article here, but I'm thinking of one way you might be able to remove it is if you keep a version of clean BIOS software around and use your motherboard manufacturer's BIOS update tool and then update the BIOS every so often with the same good code. It might get rid of it. I don't really know if that will, but it might. So there's something you can try if you think you're infected.
Yeah, that was my idea as well.
In surveillance news, thanks to MindGrinder. Internet firms co-opted for surveillance, says experts. Internet companies such as Google, Twitter, and Facebook are increasingly co-opted for surveillance work as the information they gather proves irresistible to law enforcement agencies, web experts said this week. Although such companies try to keep their users' information private, not Facebook, their business models depend on exploiting it to sell to targeted advertising, and when governments demand they hand it over, they have little choice but to comply. Now, finally someone put it in writing that for a long time we've been saying that they've been selling information or giving to governments, but no one's ever put it in writing yet, and finally someone's done it. Suggestions that BlackBerry maker RIM might give user data to British police after messenger services was used to coordinate riots this summer caused outrage, as the spying on social media users by more oppressive governments. But the vast amount of personal information that companies like Google collect to run their businesses has become simply too valuable for police and governments to ignore. Delegates to the Internet Governance Forum in Nairobi said, "When the possibility exists for information to be obtained that wasn't possible before, it's entirely understandable that law enforcement is interested. Google's chief internet evangelist, Vince Cerf," that's a weird thing, chief internet evangelist, told Reuters in an interview. "Then the issue would be, that's what's the right policy? And that, of course, engenders a lot of debate," said Cerf, who is recognized as one of the fathers of the internet for his early work in areas including communications protocols and email. "Demands from governments for internet companies to hand over user information have become routine," according to online privacy researcher activist Christopher Segoyan, who makes extensive use of freedom of information requests in his work. "Every decent-sized U.S. telecoms and internet company has a team that does nothing but respond to requests for information," Segoyan told Reuters in an interview.
Again, you know, I keep saying this. I don't know if this is just, you know, a common theme in the show or if it's, you know, just me. But again, you know, don't put your fucking information out there. You know, I recently had a dealing with a local law enforcement, and it wasn't for anything criminal. It wasn't anything like that. It's a kind of a long story. But they were essentially running a background check on me, and he specifically asked for my Facebook profile. And like, specifically. And so, that's, you know, they're looking for this stuff. You know, this guy was just a detective. So this is, you know, it wasn't like he was some, you know, from the FBI cybercrime unit. No, this is a local police detective in, you know, a fairly small suburb. So, you know, this is on the ground. You know, people are actually doing this on the ground for information finding, you know. And it's coming more and more and more, you know. The law enforcement's changing to the times. And they kind of have to keep up with it. And this is what's happening. So your data is being used against you.
Now, keep in mind, law enforcement always has been trying to get this information, always has been able to get access to it with, like, court orders and stuff like that. That's not that big of a deal. But the thing is, of course, a lot of these companies realize they have lots of data they can sell now. So they'll probably give it a lot more freely now than they would have before. Whereas before, especially companies like Google, I don't know if Google's actually selling the information yet, but they have a lot of information, and before they would hand it over if they got a court order or whatever the case may be. That happens, that's fine. But now, of course, analysts are going, well, there's a good chance that they're just going to start selling it and giving it more freely so they can make some profit off it. Now, Facebook, that's not surprising. When you're on Facebook, you're the product. You're not the customer. Don't kid yourself there. That's why you shouldn't put anything on Facebook that's important. But, of course, again, the world keeps getting worse. And oh, what the fuck news? Thanks to the doctor. Privacy nightmare. Data mine and analyze all college students' online activities. It is not uncommon for schools to be equipped with metal detectors, cameras for video surveillance, motion detectors, RFID badge tracking, computer programs to check school visitors against sex offender lists, and infrared systems to track body heat after school hours and potentially hunt down intruders. That last one isn't really a privacy concern because that's for intruders. No parent ever wants any possibility of a school tragedy. So other biometric systems in the name of security have been introduced. Iris recognition and fingerprint scans are being used to monitor students' internet usage. Now, there's a particularly invasive idea being pitched to universities as a crystal ball to stop future violence by data mining and analyzing all the college students' online activities. In K-12 students, new military and corrections technologies are quietly moving into the classroom with little oversight. It's making our schools a fertile ground for prison tech, Mother Jones reported. For millions of children, being scanned and monitored has become a part of their daily education and learning to read and write. All of the surveillance is supposed to keep students safe, but there are some states that would like to dump public school surveillance data into federally funded fusion centers. In fact, KC Education Enterprise reported that the Kansas Fusion Center, which wants to gather intelligence on public schools, the Kansas Fusion Center wants to gather intelligence in public schools. At Kansas Safe and Prepared School Conference, Jeremy Jackson, who is associated with Kansas Intelligence Fusion Center, KIFC, spoke on how schools could participate in and benefit from KIFC's intelligence analysis and information sharing capabilities. Axiom for Liberty took it one step further by posting Oklahoma Fusion Center slides, and there's a PDF here of those slides, like the one above that listed schools as non-traditional collectors of intelligence. The Oklahoma Information Fusion Center website called for entities from primary and secondary schools, post-secondary schools, colleges, universities, and technical schools to provide information related to suspicious activities occurring on and around school grounds and campuses. But there are plenty of potential privacy problems like mission creep in regards to fusion centers. Well, now there's a call for college campuses to increase school surveillance and use their crystal ball to detect future violence by mining all student data. In a Chronicle of Higher Education, Michael Morris, a lieutenant with the University Police, proposed that colleges should collect and data mine their students' online activities as a potential way to predict and thereby prevent large-scale acts of violence on campus. Morris argued that mining student data could save lives. He argued that we are under surveillance now, so what's a little more electronic spying? That's a scary argument. Morris stated that campus behavioral surveillance could offer universities a crystal ball to prevent future tragedies. They keep using that crystal ball analogy. That's pissing me off.
Yeah, I don't really like that, you know? Well, my first question is, what the fuck are these fusion centers and who actually runs them? Like, do you have any idea what these are?
I have no idea. This is the first I've heard of them. They seem to me to be like some sort of like think tank that just absorbs information and spits out results, and that's probably why they're pushing to get this other information so much, but I don't actually know what it is, so Army of Flying Monkeys, if you know, send me an email, let me know what the hell a fusion center is.
Are these run by states? Are these run by federal entities? Are they private? Which might be even scarier. You know, what exactly are these? I mean, I'm assuming a fusion center, I guess that they're taking all kinds of different, you know, intelligence sources and combining them and monitoring them and all that stuff. But, you know, I mean, this is, you know, just the gradual decline of where, you know, we don't think of, you know, our lives as our own anymore. Our lives are public 24 hours a day, you know, 7 days a week. You know, it's like that Jim Carrey movie. I can't think of the movie. Ed TV, I think it was. You know, it's like it's all being broadcast live, you know, for their entertainment. And it's, you know, the degradation of privacy. You know, there's no expectation of privacy online, on the street, in your home. There's no expectation of privacy anymore. Anything that you say is, you know, subject to being held against you.
Okay, Legion just posted. There we go. Legion just posted here. Fusion Center is a generic term for entities which are designed to integrate a federal intelligence efforts with the state and local authorities. As of July 2009, there are 72 fusion centers around the country and one in nearly every state. Well, I bet, 72 is more than 50. One of these entities work under the auspices of local law enforcement, often integrating with the state's police force, Department of Justice, or Office of Emergency Management. So do we actually know if these are run by the government or are they private and just working with the government? I think that's a pretty key distinction there. But
I think what I'm getting from it is that it's run by the government. You know, sorry, Legion, you're posting links here. We don't really have the time to be looking at these links while we're doing the show live here. But, you know, it's great to have this, you know, this information and stuff. But I'm trying to figure out a little bit more information. Who actually runs these? Because this isn't just like, okay, you know, we're just forming this and this is it. You know, who's funding them? Is the majority of the money coming from the Department of Justice? Is the majority coming from the Department of Homeland Security?
Office of Emergency Management? That originally organized by the Department of Homeland Security and Department of Justice. So originally it might mean if it changed, but because I don't have time to go into it right now, I'm going to assume it's still run by some department of government, which I guess would be better than a corporation, but not by a hell of a lot. Anyway, moving right along, in Activism Equals Terrorism News, thanks to the doctor. NYPD's terrorism training came into play at Wall Street protest. Now, I will say this article is a little bit overhyped. They didn't really go that much into terrorism training, but everyone knows that the Occupy Wall Street protest, the police were a little bit out of hand there. The NYPD defense tactics used in the Wall Street demonstrators, saying they're trained for bigger threats. A glaring mistake the protesters made, triggering the police response, is that by marching without a permit, they were breaking the law. Dun dun dun. There is no doubt the New York City police handled the Occupy Wall Street demonstration on Saturday with force. Most would call it unnecessary force, since its members began their march from the financial district to Union Square in a relatively harmless way. But when they arrived at the square and met the police, chaos erupted. Because everyone carries a cell phone with a camera, the whole chaotic scene went viral. There were shots pointing out the police officer who allegedly sprayed a group of women standing non-violently behind a police barricade. That there were young men being grabbed and dragged away by angry police. Some who just tried to speak to them. But the New York Times reports that even though this was a loose protest movement, it posed a challenge to city police. The New York City police are trained to deal with large demonstrations. The training comes from watching other anti-capitalist demonstrations, such as the Group of 20, the G20 summit, in 2009 in London, or the World Trade Organization meeting in 1999 in Seattle. The young protesters of the Occupy Wall Street group looked to the police like a real example of lawlessness that could end up in destruction and violence. The police's actions looked out of place, and they were indeed the other side of a group of officers trained to fight terrorism. Indeed, recently New York police commanders have been looking at the riots in London this summer and talking strategy about how they would prevent or stop a similar riot in New York. And it's not like the police didn't know that this protest was in the works. Since August, New York police investigators and the FBI have been monitoring the online chatter of activists seeking to bring in demonstrations to Wall Street. The police department does an internal review of its response to every large-scale demonstration, and the results so far as the protest on Saturday resulted in a large number of arrests since the demonstration regarding the Republican National Convention in 2004. The Saturday's events are not likely to go away anytime soon, especially since protesters themselves were recording the events with their cameras. As for use of pepper spray on the four vulnerable women, Paul J. Brown, the police department's chief spokesman, calls it an appropriate use and noted that it was used sparingly. Yes, I only used a little bit of the horrible spray on them, you know, because they were only a little bit disturbing to me.
You know, I mean, again, here it is with the monitoring online chatter. They're, you know, they're going to the internet for their information. It's a readily available, free intelligence source. And people are saying things and, you know, putting out, you know, sensitive information about what they're doing. You know, they're not practicing proper InfoSec, PerSec, or, you know, OpSec. And they're, you know, putting this information out there, and it's being found out and used by police departments again, you know, and, this whole, you know, well, we were trained to do bigger stuff is not an excuse. That is a fucking cop out, you know, just because you were trained to respond, you know, to one thing doesn't mean that you act that exact same way. You know, a part of being the police is that you're, you know, responding to a dynamic environment. You're supposed to use judgment. And unfortunately, it seems like whenever, you know, beat cops are, you know, put on the street and there's, you know, form up in this, you know, formation and you're now one cohesive unit and we're being, you know, given orders from the top, that's whenever shit seems to go wrong. It's whenever there's, you know, not people on the street that are reporting back that are, you know, providing good intel about what decisions to make to the police commanders. It seems like, you know, that's whenever this shit happens. So I think that's part of it. And, you know, again, this is, you know, bullshit. It's really bullshit that they're, you know, that people are buying that as their excuse, is that, oh, we were trained for bigger things. No, that's not an excuse. If you know, I said the same thing and it was, you know, something that police were responding to, you know, it wouldn't fly. You know, it wouldn't fall under the proper use of force. Well, this guy was just fighting me and he didn't have a weapon or anything, but I cracked him in the head with my baton. But that's what I was trained for. So that's what I did. Yeah, that's not going to fucking fly. That's going to get you arrested.
Same with that whole, we used it sparingly. I just can't get over that last line. It was used sparingly. But the question is, should it have been used at all? Like, if it should be used at all, then it doesn't matter how sparingly you used it, it was justified. If it wasn't supposed to be used, it doesn't matter how sparingly you used it, it wasn't justified. I just can't get over why they think that's a justification. But, I mean...
One little thing that I'd like to note here is that, I believe it was something around 700 protesters were arrested. I believe 2 or 3 days later, I believe up to, I think, 500 of them were released without charge, I think. You know, I didn't really check this before the show, but from what I saw a couple of days ago, I think 500 were released without charge.
One thing that really bugs me about these, like, especially the police trying to make tactics to deal with protesters, I understand the need for it, but they always look at the situations where it went horribly wrong. Now, what they should be doing is looking at the situations where the protest didn't end that badly, even when it was violent, and go, what did the police there do right? I mean, if you look at the Vancouver one, that was not too long ago, yeah, there was damage and stuff like that, and a few people were injured, but overall, there wasn't a whole lot of damage, there wasn't a whole lot of, people getting hurt and stuff like that, versus what it could have been if the police had decided to go and crack down on it. So, I mean, and what they did there is, instead of having lines of cops coming at people, they had cops dispersed throughout the crowd, so they could deal with problems as they propped up before it snowballed. And I just don't understand why these police forces keep going back to the whole, you know, Spartan lineup and attack strategies that seem to always end in everyone getting their asses kicked, versus doing these other strategies which tend to work better in actually defusing the situation before it gets out of hand.
Yep. And, you know, one thing that I'd just like to say here is I've noticed there's been a lot of, you know, rabid people on both sides of the, on both sides here. You know, there's a lot of people that are rabidly, you know, supporting the protesters and saying, fuck the police, all that stuff. And then there's, you know, people on the other side that are like, no, they should have, you know, fucking kicked their heads in. You know, and there's a lot of rabid people on either side and people that jump to a conclusion, you know, without either A, doing proper research, or B, getting, you know, severely slanted research. And, you know, they're just taking things as they see it instead of trying to look at the bigger picture and step back and take a bipartisan, you know, view on it. And I personally try and, you know, step back a little bit and say, I think my personal opinion on this whole New York thing is things were kind of done badly by both sides, and that both sides failed whenever things ended the way that they did. And that the things failed for the New York Police Department, and things also failed for the protesters whenever things ended up the way that they did. And I think that it's a really sad state of affairs whenever things keep ending up like this. So I think, and not only did the police department fail, not only did the protesters fail, but we failed as a society whenever this stuff happens.
Oh yeah, for sure. There was lots of stuff on all around that could have been done better. But hopefully we just learn from it and do it right next time. I kind of doubt that we will, but, you know, we can always hope. In Cold War 2.0 news, thanks to Cypros. Iran, Russia, China mulling joint missile shield. Unofficial sources have announced that Iran, Russia, and China are currently holding talks and proposing to establish a joint missile defense shield as a counterweight to the NATO defense shield, according to a recent report. The report, which was published in the Iranian daily newspaper, Kayan, on Sunday, said the sources cited 2 reasons why serious consultations have been held on the initiative. First, all 3 states have come to the conclusion that U.S. officials' assertion that their concern over the alleged missile and nuclear capabilities of Iran and North Korea is the reason for the decision to establish a NATO missile defense shield is a just pretext, and the true objective of the shield is to threaten Russia and China. In addition, now the proposal to establish an early warning radar system in southeast Turkey, which is one component of the NATO missile defense shield, appears to be a done deal. The U.S. is now planning to establish other components of the new system in South Korea and Taiwan, which clearly shows that Washington is using the alleged threat from Iran and North Korea as a pretext to target China and Russia. That's a bit of a stretch there. They could just be seeing them as a threat, which I understand. An informed expert believes that China, which has not taken any action on the issue so far, is beginning to comprehend the level of danger posed by the new system. Russia's analysis of the situation is similar to Iran's view, which was expressed during Russian Security Council's Secretary Nikolai Patrushev's recent visit to Tehran. Therefore, it seems that the three countries have realized that the time has come to seriously start discussing the plan. Some sources say Dmitry Rogozin, Russian envoy to NATO, was scheduled to travel to Iran before the end of the summer, and will probably hold operational discussions on the plan with Iranian officials. According to RIA, Novosti Rogozin is going to discuss strategic issues in Tehran. Military experts are of the opinion that since Iran, Russia, and China have made great progress in designing anti-aircraft defense systems, the construction of such a missile shield would not be a difficult task for them.
You know, I don't really think that some of this stuff is really going to come to fruition. I think it's going to be, you know, the fate of all these, you know, NATO talks and stuff. It's that there'll be compromises and compromises and compromises and compromises. And it'll take forever, and then, you know, shit'll happen. But it won't be, it'll take forever. There'll be, you know, lots of chest thumping on both sides and blah, 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 blah. But it's I don't think it's going to be nearly as bad as they're reporting it this to be.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. Russia, China, and the U.S. all know, and they've known for years now, that if they went to war, like straight-out war, they would all destroy each other, and probably the rest of the planet with them. So I seriously doubt they're ever going to go into any kind of direct conflict. This might actually go as far as having these missile shields built, but I sincerely doubt that they would actually ever be used, just because of the fact that now, ever since the Russia-U.S. Cold War, where we came very close to destroying the world quite a few times, we've pretty much put safeguards in place to make sure we don't jump the gun and destroy each other.
Yeah, mutually assured destruction is not good for either country.
Especially now when we've got a three-way system here going. In maggot-stopping news, thanks to Maltos, Russia introduces chemical castration of pedophiles. The Russian parliament has approved a new law on pedophilia in a first reading. From now on, people found guilty of sex crimes against children under the age of 14 will face chemical castration, or repeat offenders will face a life sentence. According to the new law, the decision on a convict's obligatory chemical castration will be made through a forensic psychiatrist report requested by the court, which will ultimately turn to other medical measures. MP Dmitry Vatican, explained to ITAR TASS, it would be unwise to limit the medical measures to just castration. In some cases, that may not help, Vatican said. At the same time, some of the convicts may ask for voluntary chemical castration, even if the victim was over 14. This may help them get parole if they're already serving a sentence, or a more lenient sentence if they are still being tried. However, the latter case, the final decision will be up to the court. The law also banned suspended and deferred sentences of those found guilty of sex crimes against a child under the age of 14, and from now on, they can ask for parole only after serving at least 80% of their sentence. The new law comes amid increased concerns over sexual transgressions against minors in Russian society. A staggering 1,300 Russian children suffered from sexual crime involving violence in 2008, and there are 5,233 from non-violent sexual crimes, according to Anton Belvakov, the MP for the Loyalist Just Russia Party. Belvakov was among those calling for severe punishments on pedophiles, as some 97% repeat offenses after being released. United Russia MP Tatiana Yakovleva, I guess, claims that the number of sexual crimes against underage has increased 20-fold since 2005. Holy shit. Pedophiles are sick and dangerous people who are never to be full members of society. This is why our goal is to protect healthy people, our children, who have their whole lives ahead of them, Belvakov said. Belvakov told RA Novosti. The previous laws on sex crimes, including against juveniles, were more lenient, with the toughest sentence being an 8 to 15 year prison term. That was the toughest sentence. And as legal practice shows, many pedophiles received terms of 3 to 4 years through plea bargaining. Now, for those of you who don't know, my views on pedophilia kind of mirror Sean's.
Yep, I'm about the same here. You know, I really don't have too much of a problem with this. The only thing that I'm worried about here is that if they were convicting innocent people and sending them to castration, and they found out afterwards, after they'd already been castrated, that they were, you know, not guilty. So, and you know, there, unfortunately, there's always a percentage, you know, regardless of how good your system is, of false convictions. But, I would really hope that the way that they implement it is, you know, very smart in the way that they do it, and their criteria isn't too lenient, and their criteria isn't too tight either. So, you know, you're genuinely taking violent sexual offenders, you know, off of the streets and making sure that they can't do this again.
Yeah, one thing I would change about this law is I'd probably change the chemical castration to be only for repeat offenders. So if you do it like 3 times or more, then it becomes an option to chemically castrate you. But of course, at the same time, they're already putting a life sentence on the table for those people, which is probably a better option overall anyway.
Oh, I agree. You know, I'm not so sure. I'm not sure if I quite agree with you on the whole repeat offender thing. I mean, the way that I look at it, and I try not to, you know, let it, you know, get too much hype, because it's exactly what the media does, is, you know, going for, oh, for the children. But the way that I think of it is, you know, for each repeat offense before this happens is another child that's permanently damaged. And I think that that's absolutely wrong. That's, you know, probably one of the most fucked up things I can think of.
I'm looking at it from the opposite direction. False convictions happen. That happens. But if you get one person being repeated the same offense multiple times, the chances of that person actually being innocent fall dramatically after a couple times. So that's why
I think
the hardest sentences should be for repeat offenders, because then you're pretty sure that they are actually a bag of shit before you lock them away forever and throw away the key.
I would feel, I think, a little bit more comfortable with saying, you know, setting a hard line at 2. You know, if you do 2, you're fucking done. You know, that's it. Do not pass go, do not collect $200. Because, you know, with the 97%, you know, I really hate that, but there's still a 3%, which is quite a high number, unfortunately. You know, 3%, if you're part of that 3%, you know, that's not a repeat offender, then, you know, yeah, that's kind of sucks. But, you know, I think that if it's, you know, if I'd be more comfortable setting a hard line at 2. You know, not 2 or 3 or maybe 4, you know, I'm thinking hard line at 2. If you do it 2, you're done, and you're either chemically castrated and sentenced to life in prison, or you're sentenced to life in prison.
Yeah, my hard line's at 3, but that's neither here nor there. In permanent record news, thanks to the doctor. Even those cleared of crimes can stay on the FBI's watch list. Federal Bureau of Investigation is now permitted to include people on the government's terrorist watch list even if they have been acquitted of terrorist-related offenses or the charges are dropped, according to newly released documents. The files, released by the FBI under the Freedom of Information Act, disclose now how the police are instructed to react if they encounter a person on the list. They lay out, for the first time in public view, the legal standard for national security officials must meet in order to add a name to the list, and they shed new light on how new names are vetted for possible removal from the list. Inclusion on the watch list can keep terrorism suspects off planes, block non-citizens from entering the country, and subject people to delays and greater scrutiny at airports, border crossings, and traffic stops. The database now has over 42,000 new names, including 8,000 Americans, according to statistics released in connection on the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. About 16,000 people, including about 500 Americans, are barred from flying. Really, only 500 Americans? I thought it'd be higher than that, but whatever. Timothy J. Healy, the director of the FBI's Terrorism Screening Center, which vets requests to add or remove names from the list, said documents show that the government was balancing civil liberties with a careful, multi-layer process of vetting who goes on it, and for making sure that the names no longer need to be on it came off.
There really shouldn't be balancing civil liberties. That's not the point of civil liberties. But, you know, moving on to that, I'm, you know, pleasantly surprised that there's only 500 Americans on this list. I feel slightly more, you know, comfortable, or not comfortable, but slightly more pleased. I was just like you, I was expecting more to be on that. So, you know, I'm pleasantly surprised by that. But with the sheer number here, 16,000 people, you also have to remember that they're taking, you know, biometric data and identities of foreign or fighters that they find in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they're also adding those guys to the list as well. So you have to take that into account, just with the sheer numbers. But I really think that they need to include more information, more identifying information on these, because, you know, some of them are like ridiculously common names, and I've heard of. You know, I believe that in one case, a 6-year-old boy who wasn't allowed to board a plane because somebody who had his same name was on the terrorism watch list. So it created this huge problem that was eventually solved, but, you know, it took a while, and they essentially were detaining a 6-year-old because he was on the terrorism watch list and he was trying to board a plane with his parents. So I think that, you know, names these days, I mean, we have, you know, a couple billion people here on the planet. Names are, you know, just a couple of words slapped together. We need to have more identifying information with stuff like this. You know, and I'm a little bit wary that, you know, they're including, you know, all these watch lists and stuff like that to beat cops and stuff like that. Because it just, you know, these guys are, you know, normal, you know, everyday cops, you know. And they already have enough on their plates as is. The last thing that we need is, you know, them freaking out over, you know, pulling you over.
Oh yeah, they definitely need to have a lot more identifying information. And I also think they should put a little bit of information there for the frontline police on what they're on the list for, so that you can have a more proportional response. If you actually find the guy on the watch list, then you're gonna go talk to him, kind of thing. You know, is he on the watch list for something stupid like being a political dissident, or is he on the watch list because he was an enemy fighter? They're a bit of a different response there you're going to need. So, yeah, it scares me that people aren't going to get off the list if they get acquitted of all the crimes that they're being accused of. But at the same time, I'm actually really surprised that the list is so small. And that's a pleasant surprise from our end.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's ridiculous that they have. It's so difficult to get off of this list, especially if you've been cleared of charges and stuff like that. I think that's not cool, but again, you know, as a kind of unrelated thing, this is an observation. I'm pleased that it's so small, you know, Americans. That makes me happy.
In Cyberbrain news, thanks to the doctor, cyborg rat gets computerized cerebellum. Researchers at Tel Aviv University have given a rat an artificial brain part, the cerebellum, to restore lost functions, thereby ushering in the era of true brain-to-computer communications for humans. Maddie Minns, professor of psychobiology, and his colleagues have built a computerized cerebellum and linked it to the anesthetized rat whose own cerebellum was disabled. The cerebellum is the round, cue ball-sized structure in the back of the brain, in the back of the human brain. It's not cue ball-sized in a rat, of course, that controls how messages get from the brain to the body and back again. Critically, it controls the timing of movement, which is why injuries to the cerebellum cause people to lose their balance or suffer motor control disorders, rather than paralysis. Minns presented his work at the Strategies for Engineering Negligible Senescence Foundation at a meeting in Cambridge, England. According to attaching the synthetic cerebellum to the rat, the scientists tried to condition it to blink at the sound of a tone. To get the rat to blink, they first fired a puff of air at the rat, and the tone was sounded, and then just sounded the tone. The experiment worked. The rat blinked when it heard the sound. When a synthetic cerebellum was disconnected, the rat would not learn the response. This means that they got the artificial cerebellum to receive information from one part of the brain and send it back to another. This is a big advance from previous brain-computer interfaces, such as prosthetic limbs or computer controls, which send information only one way. So basically, this can read information from the brain and write it back to the brain so it can actually get a full two-way communication going.
This is very cool, you know, and I think that's, you know, again, like they said, a huge step for prosthetics. And just as a you know, related side note here, there was on the BBC, they had a report that says how monkeys have been trained to control a virtual arm on a computer screen using only their brain waves. And I'll put up a link in the show notes and put it up in the chat here in Second Life, and you guys could check that out. But I saw that and thought that it was interesting. So just wanted to interject there with that.
And I want to end up the show on a little bit of a high note here, because we had some bad news in the show. And we're winning news, thanks to Wyandi. Supreme Court legalizes downloading music. Now, there's a caveat to this I'll mention at the end. The United States Supreme Court has refused an appeal that would have made downloading music an infringement of federal copyright law. Take that, Metallica. The American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, or ASCAP, has been attempting to appeal the Supreme Court in an early ruling by an appeals court in New York that said that downloaded song constituted a public performance of the song under federal copyright law. Attorneys from the ASCAP are fighting to reverse the decision in hopes that they would be able to collect additional royalties off of songs downloaded from the web. ASCAP insisted that digital downloads were on par with public performances, which would thus allow copyright owners to receive compensation for each download. A federal judge and an appeals court had rejected the argument. However, now the Supreme Court is also refusing to hear it. According to the appeals court, music is neither recited, rendered, nor played in a recording, electronic or otherwise, is simply delivered to a potential listener. U.S. Solicitor General Donald Verrilli agreed with the appeals ruling, and just because a song is transferred over the internet does not mean it is being performed, reports Reuters, which is actually pretty technical savvy, which is good to see this, and judges actually kind of understand how downloading works. But I'd like to note here, this doesn't actually mean you can just like go and download music and no one can come after you and stuff like that. As far as I can tell, the RIAA or whoever else can still sue you. There's still other rulings that they might be able to get to make this completely legal. What this means right now, though, is that downloading music is not an infringement of federal copyright law, which means it's not a federal crime. So it's not completely open and clear for you guys down the states yet, but it is a good step forward.
Yep, it's definitely a step in the right direction here, and I think that if we, you know, keep working for it and keep pushing for it, hopefully we can make a difference and we can, you know, legalize file sharing. And that's the ultimate hope here. And in Recomedia here, we have the Aurora Borealis, as seen from the International Space Station, thanks to Fat Ninja. And just a note to Hugo here is that it's actually Aurora, not Aurora Borealis.
Yes, I know. Again, I'm fighting with
autocorrect. Which is actually seen here in the show notes. But this is really cool. We actually are experiencing just around here a spike in the Aurora Borealis activity, and it's actually able to be visible as far south as Colorado, I believe it is. And what else we have here is the BBC is speechless as traitor tells the truth, the collapse is coming, and Goldman rules the world, thanks to Cycros. So that's just an interesting little video there from the BBC. And in Cyberpunk Kit, we have GPS receivers small enough to attach almost anything to, thanks to Jules Verboven. And with a tiny enough GPS sensor, it is possible to track the location of anything from your lost keys to a runaway pet. That's because the world's smallest GPS receiver is now smaller than a penny and weighs only 0.3 grams. But that's just the chip. What about all the electronics required to make it truly useful? And what they don't have here is also a battery, like a system for remotely downloading the data it is logged. The GPS logger weighs 10 grams, and most of which is a battery. Custom made by Telemetry Solutions of Concord, California. It's small enough to attach to a fruit bar for research purposes. Fruit bat, not fruit bar. So, excuse me there. Data can be downloaded directly from the chip upon recapture, or it can be downloaded wirelessly from up to 500 meters away. So that's about 1,500, 1,600 feet for us Americans there. But, and then what else we have is an emulator, an amazing multi-touch DJ technology, thanks to Maltos. The emulator, which is an amazing multi-touch DJ technology, allows DJs and music makers to control their sound with their hands in unprecedented ways. Take your iPad and blow it up to 10 times its size, make it translucent, and then allow it to run third-party software that's not currently available at the App Store. Then you've got emulator. The system pushes the boundaries in human-computer interaction to sever the barrier between man and music, allowing the user to feel the music and affect it in ways that return to analog innocence. And Hugo's note here is, well, you can buy a hardware package from them. This is mainly a software package, and it seems that it will run on most multi-touch devices that you happen to have. And, you know, there's been some things like this which have kind of come down the pike in the last maybe 5 years or so. And there's definitely really interesting ways that new instruments and new ways to manipulate music have been coming down. And something else that I have here is the Army is showing off their Soldier smartphone beta. And let's see. The U.S. Army's NetWarrior system, that's N-E-T-T, Warrior, an expensive program that's tried and failed for 20 years to connect soldiers to one another through a suite of wearable computers, radios, and keyboards. Now, it's a device that weighs under a pound and connects to a radio, and it will very likely run on Google's Android operating systems. This means no iPod. This, you know, isn't Windows Mobile or anything like that. Nope, this is running on Android. And 8 to 15 pounds pieces of kit to slap on a soldier already humping a ton of body armor. No more banana-shaped keyboards hanging down from a load clip, no more cables connecting the whole thing that tangle a soldier up, and no more funky monocle attached to a helmet for a heads-up display. NetWarrior, a descendant of another failed program called Land Warrior, which kind of went by the wayside in maybe 2004, 2005, I'd like to say, has finally joined the 21st century, with one very important distinction. Quote unquote, "This is not a phone," clarifies Brigadier General Camille Nichols, the leader of the Army office called Program Executive Officer Soldier. So that's P-E-O-S, in charge of the NetWarrior program, and that could be a problem. For the last few months, skip ahead here. On Thursday morning, to a small group of reporters, the Army made it official. The end user device is the new brain, heart, and soul of NetWarrior. It's an Android device. NetWarrior's ears and mouth will remain a radio, specifically the Army's Joint Tactical Radio System. Taken together, the system will weigh less than 3 pounds, with more than 2 of those pounds coming from the rifleman radio. The end-user device won't be Wi-Fi enabled. In fact, if the Army has its way, it won't ever connect to a civilian network. It'll hook into the Army's brand new data nets, and as well as other classified military networks. The devices themselves will encrypt data that they store, and there will be another level of encryption when transmitting or receiving data. Soldiers who are used to smartphones they carry in civilian life will find the end-user device is pretty familiar. Up to a point, apps? I don't know, maybe. It's got them. Though the kinks are being worked out, Nichols said that she anticipates the devices will connect to the Army's forthcoming App Store marketplace, which was exclusively reported on in April. There, or perhaps loaded onto the device from jump, soldiers will find a variety of useful apps. A civilian directly overseeing NetWarrior, Bill Brower, said the device will run a mapping and tracking function similar to Blue Force Tracker. If any of you are familiar with, or were in the military, you know what Blue Force Tracker is. It's essentially a quote-unquote real-time. It's not really real-time. Really finicky, essentially IFF system, where it identifies different Blue Force Tracker units, and it shows all the different units laid out on a tactical map. So that's essentially what it is. And it's, you know, very old software. It's like from the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, and it's finicky, it's a pain in the ass, and it doesn't work very well. A program that lets soldiers keep track of where their colleagues are on a battlefield to avoid friendly fire incidents and know how far away help is. There will be a mission planning tool that lets commanders design and then send out plans for a given task. So this is essentially, they're using, like I said, specifically Android devices, and they will be testing a whole bunch of, the new NetWarrior is moving at full speed ahead. By mid-2012, the Army will figure out which manufacturer will make the NetWarrior end-user device, and they are going to be testing all kinds of stuff from specifically designed hardware all the way up to consumer-grade technology they're going to be doing field tests with to see what exactly they would like to use. So I found that, and I thought that was really interesting. And then for your daily hack, we have dual floppy drive music, again, thanks to Jewel Verboven. Remember the days when floppy drives were all the rage? Well, I don't miss those slow, noisy things. It's hard to believe that a large floppy drive that once held 1.44 megabytes of data, you would need 10 of them to store a modern picture these days. Thankfully, there is still use for these relics. You can connect them to a custom microcontroller and have it play some music using the stepper motors that move the read/write heads.
Don't worry, we will be back next week to make sure you can get the news you need to survive. If you cannot contribute to the show, please distribute it. We'd like to thank the Army of Flying Monkeys for assistance in gathering data. If you have any news stories or pertinent information you want to send us, you can reach us at news@rostudios.org. That's news@rostudios.org. If you like the music in the background, check out Retro by Mind in a Box. We fade out now with a track from an album called 8 Bits. Remember everyone, we cannot defeat the enemy if we're at each other's throats, so until next time, that's what server said. End of line.